election reform or voter suppression? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, it's a measure likely to be signed into law in Florida, but critics say it will make it harder for you to vote by mail. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, big heads up for parents out there. The deadline to enroll your student in the Florida prepaid program is coming up this Friday. What you need to know about that? That's later, but first, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The case count in Florida since the pandemic began now stands at 2.21 million, with 36 more deaths over the weekend. The death toll in the state stands at 34,847. At the same time, 8.5 million Florida residents have gotten at least one dose of a vaccine so far, 5.2 million both doses. Keep vaccinating, everybody. Well, our top story this morning, new legislation in Florida is being criticized as voter suppression. If it's signed into law, the measure would essentially make it harder in this state to vote by mail. It's part of a coordinated effort across dozens of states to curtail access to the ballot in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. Patricia Brigham is president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, and she's on the line. Patricia Brigham, good to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
What are your questions about voting by mail in Florida and what this new bill, if signed into law, will do? Give us a call. Already getting lots of tweets. We'll get to those in a moment. But the number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Patty Brigham, this bill is called Election Administration, and it's being touted by its sponsors in the legislature as reforming election laws and ensuring ballot integrity. Can you tell us what this bill would do and why your organization, the League of Women Voters of Florida, is opposed?
I certainly can. First of all, this bill is not needed. Even Governor DeSantis praised Florida's elections as being a model of how to do them, and then turned around in the same breath and said, but we need major election reform. Talk about a contradiction. We put on a great election in 2020. All eyes were on Florida, thinking that that wouldn't happen based on past debacles, but indeed it did. So we're trying to fix a something that is not broken. The bill, Senate Bill 90, is going to be heard on the Senate floor today, debated, and it will be voted upon. It's going to do a number of things that will make it harder for voters to vote, frankly, and we believe that's a form of voter suppression.
And how? Let's talk about the mechanics of the bill. It does a number of things. Can you tick off the list of what this would do? What are the changes people will notice when they go to vote?
Sure. Well, there are a number of changes, but some of the more significant ones, for example, the bill would slash the hours that voters could deposit their ballots in those drop boxes by nearly two-thirds, and would require the boxes to be staffed in person by the supervisor of election employees every moment they're open. Now, currently, there's no restriction on when you can turn your ballot in. Now there would be. That was part of the convenience of the ballot drop box. You could take it whenever it was convenient to you, the voter, and Florida being a tourism state, many service workers live here and work odd hours, and those boxes, those ballot drop boxes, are very convenient to them. So the ballot drop box would have to be staffed when it was open, and they would be open only during the hours that early voting sites are open. And to make it even worse for our supervisors of election, if the ballot drop box was open when this law, if it passes into law, this bill, was open when it shouldn't be, The bill would slap a $25,000 fine on any supervisor who gives voters access to that Dropbox after hours. That is just outrageous. Punishing supervisors of elections for making it easier for voters to vote is just the antithesis of what we should be doing to make voting accessible to Floridians. Mm.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Former State Senator Alan Hayes is a Republican who's now one of those supervisors of elections. In Lake County, Florida, he did testify to a Senate committee that election supervisors around the state oppose the removal of drop boxes and any other efforts to make voting by mail less convenient in Florida. He says the bill would impose operational and financial hardships and restrict access to voting for no apparent reason. Patty Brigham, this bill, which does some other things, too, that we can talk about, but for people that haven't followed it closely, I think you covered the biggest parts of it. This bill, it doesn't stand on its own. There are bills in a couple of dozen states around the country right now that seek to do similar things. And, of course, to our north, Georgia passed a very strict bill restricting access to the ballot that critics have likened to a piece of Jim Crow legislation. And so let's talk about this in the broader context. These bills are all a reaction to the false belief among many Republican voters out there that the 2020 presidential election was not free and fair. Can you talk about that?
That just shows you the danger of disinformation. The 2020 election was proven to be fair. There was no fraud. And the fact that we had a former president casting doubt on vote by mail and the ways that he did, even though he voted by mail, created doubt in the minds of many who would turn to that method of voting, especially during COVID. It just shows you what disinformation can do. Now, in Florida, we know that millions of voters use vote by mail, and those ballot drop boxes, 1.5 million voters use them. So the original version of Senate Bill 90 would have eliminated those boxes altogether. An amendment was put in that would put them back into a play, but restrict the times that they're available. In addition, what's troubling about this new law is the level of detail to which it goes into in telling supervisors and state election officials how to do their job. Our supervisors of elections know how to do their jobs, and they proved it last year when they put on a great election. They have to post the number of vote-by-mail ballots requested on a database, the number received, the numbers ballots not yet counted. They must record the date each ballot was requested, the date they took it to the post office, and whether the elector's signature seems to match the one in the precinct register. Another provision in this bill, which has received quite a bit of attention, is it outlaws the distribution of water to voters standing in line to cast ballots. Why? Florida's hot, even in November. And if there are long lines, and if you limit the access to these voting drop boxes, you're going to see longer lines at early vote sites and at the polls. And people may need water, and there are groups out there who go out and get food, water, whatever, and make voting kind of celebratory, which it should be. But no, unless you're a employee of the supervisor's office, you can't pass out water to the voter. That's just wrong.
And that provision of the bill, I think you're right, has really raised eyebrows, and it's not unlike provisions in Georgia and other states. When we talk about this as part of a national effort, and it's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about this voting bill moving through the legislature. Patty Brigham, the legislation did eliminate some of the most stringent restrictions that its sponsors originally wanted. They wanted to ban drop boxes for ballots altogether. They wanted a requirement for there to be a physical signature on file rather than a digital signature for the voter to identify themselves. Although there are still additional ID requirements for absentee voting, new powers for observers to oversee vote tabulation, limits on who can drop off ballots, and also new requirements for voters to request an absentee or vote by mail ballot. If this passes, you'll have to request it every year, every election cycle, right?
That's right. And so this is going to catch a lot of voters, if this bill passes, which it likely will, unaware. Supervisors are going to have to do a massive education campaign to let voters know they have to re-up their vote-by-mail status. And that's going to cost a lot of money. And where is that money going to come from? Of course, groups like the League of Women Voters will educate the public about voting. That's what we do. But to put this extra burden on the supervisors who are trying to do their job, and now their job has been complicated when they're already doing a good job, is just wrong. It just feels wrong, and one suspects that there are other motives at play here.
And what do you believe those motives are?
We believe this is an attempt at outright voter suppression. And as you mentioned, Melissa, these bills are going through in multiple states, I believe, over 40. And you have one party, and we're nonpartisan, but this is a fact. You have one party who's pushing these bills. And these bills are strong attempts to complicate the voting process, which shouldn't be the case. Make access to voting tougher, and just confuse the voters, frankly.
Let's go to some calls now for Patricia Brigham. She's president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, 549-2937. Mary in San Marco. Hi, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I don't understand all of the consternation over the drop boxes when every single mailbox, including your own in your front by your front door or neighborhood, is also a legal drop box. It seems to me that that's accessible to everyone and that they're blowing this drop box thing out of proportion.
Thanks, Mary. What about that, Patty? You can mail your ballot in.
Sure, and Mary makes a good point. However, there's another piece of this legislation that I believe is in the House bill where the voter, when they drop, he or she drops off his ballot into that drop box, would have to show identification. Now, if you go over to a mailbox, put a stamp on the signed and sealed envelope containing your ballot, you don't show ID to anybody at the mailbox. So to show ID at the drop box, which is something you haven't had to do before, makes no sense at all. These drop boxes are put in place to make voting easier. And to address another part of the question, last year there were problems with the U.S. Postal Service. There are voters, and we are still concerned about those problems. The mail was slowed down. People did not trust the Postal Service. And so they turned to early voting via those drop boxes.
Right. Certainly, there are some voters out there who believe there was an attempt to deliberately slow the mail down leading up to the November election.
There was that suspicion.
The postmaster, Louis DeJoy, has denied that. It's 549-2937. Linda is in Mandarin. Linda, hello.
Hey, I just wanted to mention that why I think that our democracy is teetering is because when you get a group of politicians that, based on a lie, are too inept to actually come up with great ideas where the populace would want to vote for them. Instead, they want to restrict the people who don't care that they didn't run on a platform. Maybe they, you know, in Georgia, I mean, Florida was a lock, but many states, maybe they didn't have enough ideas for people to say, hey, I want to choose this person over this person. Instead, they want to locked down to people who they think will vote for them. And I just think that is so horrible in a democracy. And it seems like the thing that concerns me where these are going, that we're going to be a third world country where we're going to then come up with somebody who will take Donald Trump plus two and take this into an autocracy. And I'm just concerned that politicians want to keep their power, aren't thinking about 10 years from now. They're thinking about next year in 2022. And it's really a sad day in this wonderful country we call America. Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. You know, Patricia, this new law, and it is likely to become law, critics of it think that it's an attempt to suppress the vote among populations that might be more likely to vote Democratic. But the truth is, because of the way it's written, it really might have the effect of suppressing the votes of people of all political persuasions. It's not necessarily going to just suppress one side of the aisle.
That's right. It's going to affect every single voter. And certainly some voters will be more affected. For example, the elderly. You know, you have to have an immediate family member take your ballot in and drop it off. What if you don't have an immediate family member in your area? Currently, now, I will say that there was a good amendment that was accepted and will probably be voted on with the entire bill today that would still allow for nursing homes to make arrangements with supervisor's offices to exchange the ballots for those residents in nursing homes who are not mobile and not able to do that. But what if you are a senior and you live by yourself? You have to go through all sorts of rigmarole to get someone to be able to drop off your ballot legally. So, you know, there are certain segments of the population that are going to be hurt more than others. But you're right. Every single voter is going to be affected by this bill because the bill is attempting to complicate the voting process and make voting harder and just cut accessibility.
Lots of tweets about this. Paula tweets the show, "I believe the motive behind the new law is voter suppression. Not allowing the passing of water to long lines of hot and thirsty voters. Malicious pettiness," she says. Roger tweets us, "What a shame that the elections were held without fraud. A Republican supervisor of elections agreed." And he's talking about multiple people. "Florida needs to increase the franchise, not suppress the vote." And many more tweets in that same vein. Patricia Brigham, the bill is getting its final review this week, yes?
Yes, the Senate bill will be heard on the Senate floor today for its last hearing. It will be debated and it will be voted on. The House version of this bill is House Bill 7041. It's been heard in its final committee and been placed on the calendar, and we don't, for the full floor, we don't know when it will be heard yet. They're going to have to reconcile these two bills so they match. We're curious to see how they're going to go about doing that.
So it passes into law, and do you anticipate legal challenges to this measure?
Yes, we do, and I'm sure there will be a flood of legal challenges to these measures.
Let's talk about that, because of course Florida is already facing a federal lawsuit for another controversial bill that passed last week. It's been called an anti-riot or an anti-protest bill, and that one is facing a federal court challenge. The bills that have come out of the legislature this session there've been a lot of controversial bills that have come out of the Florida legislature over the years, but I think it's fair to say that this session in particular has drawn the ire of millions of Florida voters out there, particularly in this time of pandemic when people are suffering so much. That a measure to restrict voting and a measure to, critics say, to criminalize protest have been the legislature's top priorities. What are your thoughts?
the critics are right, and the voters should, all Floridians should be outraged. I mean, we are still under COVID-19. And instead of focusing on healthcare and the massive unemployment problems as a result of COVID, what's the number one priority of the governor? In fact, the House bill on anti-protest was number one, House Bill 1. And they are looking for problems that really didn't plague Florida. I mean, let's face it, this House Bill 1 was announced during the summer at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests. Most of those protests were peaceful. Some, yes, did turn violent. That's a fact. But this is an anti-First Amendment bill that would punish protesters who weren't even doing anything illegal in a protest just because somebody else does. That is, we believe, well, we're curious to see if that would hold up in court as being constitutional. And, you know, as you pointed out, there's already been a lawsuit filed on that, and there will probably be more. The fact that the legislature is taking advantage, and frankly, they are taking advantage of COVID-19, limiting public testimony, using COVID as a cover to do that, making it harder for the public to testify, it's absolutely dumbfounding, frankly, that they're acting as if they just don't care. They're going to do whatever they want to do. And if the public doesn't like it, too bad.
We're out of time, but I do want to make mention of the fact that the League of Women Voters of Florida has a longstanding presence in this space, doing voter education efforts and trying to make sure people understand the elections process. And so it's always good to have you on the show. And I want to thank you for your time. She's Patricia Brigham, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And Melissa, you can bet we'll be stepping up our voter education efforts should these bills pass.
We'll check back with you because this could take effect in July, this new measure, just in time for the 2022 midterm elections. And much more still ahead later. What you need to know this week to sign up your student for the Florida prepaid program for college. But up next.
It's in everything I do in my life, in every relationship. How I just it's part of who I am, not kind of what I do.
First Coast CEO Jesus Garay on his climb to success. We'll be right back.
Citizens Property Insurance. Whether recovering or preparing, Citizens is available. Claims can be tracked at citizensfla.com or reported by calling a live Citizens rep 24/7.
First Coast Success is sponsored by Iberia Bank.
Back. Well, Jesus Garay, MBA, is the owner and CEO at Global Freight and Commerce. He shares his business secrets with Karen Mathis of the Jax Daily Record in today's First Coast Success.
Jesus Garay launched Global Freight and Commerce, LLC, in 2014 after 20 years of service in the U.S. Army, specializing in senior strategic operations. Senator Marco Rubio honored him during National Veterans Small Business Week in 2019, and Jax Chambers Transportation and Logistics Council chose him as its 2021 Small Business Leader of the Year. Jesus Garay, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thanks for having me.
Brief us on the operations of Global Freight and Commerce.
So we are a full-service regional and OTR, which stands for over-the-road trucking company, specializing in reefer, refrigerated, and dry goods.
During your service with the U.S. Army, your 10 duty stations and 6 deployments included Iraq, Bosnia, Africa, and more than 5 years in South Korea. What can you tell us about serving in senior strategic operations?
When I use the words strategic, I like to use dominoes as the example. in the strategic realm of anything you do in life, you'll spend more time lining up the dominoes intellectually so that you only have to flick the very first one, thus creating momentum or snowball effect. When you're not operating strategically, you're going through the motions of knocking out each task individually, which creates monotony, and it doesn't allow you for supervision. You're just in the weeds of every single task, and then you're missing things on the periphery.
Now, how did that work with you starting your business? Is that the way you operate?
It's in everything I do in my life, in every relationship. It's part of who I am, not kind of what I do. But in my business, I actually started my business before I left the Army. I was a real estate investor for 14 out of my 20 years. So at the 6-year mark, I bought my first house, and my wife and I ended up flipping a couple of hundred homes. We retired with a bunch of homes. But I got into transportation with all my travels throughout the world about 2.5 years before I even retired. So I knew when I hit the ground, I was going to hit the ground running. Subsequently, when I retired from the Army, I relocated back to Jacksonville, which is where I'm from originally, specifically because of the ports and the I-10 meets 95 and all that. Because it is going to be a big deal in the future.
So Jacksonville is your home?
Jacksonville is where I'm from. I was born in Bronx, New York. Moved here when I was 6 years old. Grew up in the Myrtle Avenue district of Jacksonville until I was about 20. Tried my hand at college basketball, and that didn't necessarily work. And so I joined the Army, where I finished school, got my MBA, traveled the world, started businesses, and the rest is history.
Well, what are the challenges and the advantages of being a veteran-owned business?
I'll start with the advantages. The advantages are, this is a big military town. So when people know that you're retired military or you're a veteran-owned business, they typically lean towards helping you. Some of the challenges may be, and it's, I don't see it as a disadvantage, it's a challenge, is that I've only been home five years. And so I don't have those 20 or 25-year legacy relationships that allow me to tap into all these resources that are already here. Whenever I meet someone, I'm asking them to break up with their girlfriend. Right, they are already performing the service that I'm trying to ask them to do. So sometimes when you move across the world, all over the world, and you've been performing all these amazing tasks for your country, when you come back home, you got to find a place to put in roots. You just don't have those legacy relationships. So that's kind of what I'm doing now.
How do you do that?
With things like joining the chamber, right? I got some fantastic relationships through my abilities and through my friendships at the chamber. But I first came in that first year just trying to help them. Hey, who do you need to meet? Who do I need to bring to you? As an African-American, one of the things that they're trying to do, and I'm always trying to do, is add more diversity to any team I'm on. So I've subsequently been able to help bring a lot of African-Americans and Hispanics and just any typical numerical minority to the chamber, and it's much more robust conversations being had with some of the, not just business, but political and social issues going on in our country right now.
Well, how do you define your leadership style?
As I see it, there are two types of leadership styles. People may disagree, but here's how I see it. You have independent and you have codependent. Codependent leaders, from my purview, seem to have the need for things to go right when they're there, right? There's something that they're missing personally, so they don't actually pour into the subordinates as much to make them as qualified as them, fearing they may take their job, take their position, go out and start their own business. For me, I'm having to have more of an independent leadership style. If it's in your destiny to be with me for 2 or 3 years, and I groom you to be the best executive or the best person that you could possibly be, and then you go start your business, well, that's what the universe had in store for you. But I don't want things to go right just while I'm around. When I'm not here, like I am now, I'm at your office, and my office is off Normandy Boulevard. I need things to go right, and so I spend a tremendous amount of time pouring into the young people, trying to make them the best executives possible.
Well, have you recovered from the pandemic?
We're still in a pandemic. So I took some lumps. I took some licks, and that's good for me, right? Because when I'm a big company, I need to draw on these experiences, right? And so it made me more resilient. It made me more creative. And we came out of that thing. I'm actually on the strongest possible trajectory than I could possibly be. But, yeah, we definitely took our licks during the pandemic.
When do you foresee or project that it may be over for your business?
Maybe what over?
The pandemic.
I don't need it to be over for me to operate. That is out of my control. And what I need to just do is stay abreast to it, stay informed to make sure I'm taking care of my people and to include the drivers on the ground. But whether it's over or not, because some studies say we're going to be dealing with this for 50 to 100 years, you need to be prepared to be able to operate in that dynamic, not necessarily wait for it to be over for you to be successful.
Well, what is your advice to other entrepreneurs?
So one of the things that I'm 49 now, and I've been an entrepreneur for kind of a long time. One of the things that I'm hearing now is the young entrepreneurs, a lot of people seek my counsel. I don't know why, but whatever. But what I hear now from young people is this whole work-life balance thing. This has come to the forefront of a lot of people's minds, and I just have one piece of information or one piece of advice for that. A lot of your administrative tasks can be front-loaded in your day. I'm in my home office by 4 in the morning. I'm typically at my office, usually whenever I want to go to my office, because my general manager kind of runs things. But there's a lot that I can get done when my wife and kids are asleep, right? So typically, I'm actually done with my portion of the day before 6 a.m. The second order of effect, like the next domino to that, is when nothing fires someone up more than getting in their inbox, their email inbox at 9:30 in the morning, and seeing that you sent them an email at 4:57 in the morning. Because what it's going to send is the message like, this guy's not playing. He is not playing. He's serious about this. And that's how we rank choice our emails. We look at the timestamp on them. So front loading your day helps you save family time so you can actually be mindful of the work-life balance. But getting those important emails out, getting that important period of reading and digesting and consuming information, if you do that early in the morning when no one's bothering you and you're actually not missing any family time because everybody's asleep, it actually allows you to be more productive, have a greater impact, and then save some of the back end of your day for whatever leisure time you want to use.
What else would you like to share?
So we had everybody had a rough year, right? This is good for America. I think this is good. I've traveled all over the world. This is how most countries live on a yearly basis. There's always something. Political unrest, social unrest, business. There's always something going on. They have pandemics yearly. So for our country, although you don't necessarily want to go through these things, it makes the country it makes you a little tougher, more resilient. However, what I would say is I am one of the people, one of hundreds and thousands of people who we're trying to rebrand capitalism, right? People don't understand the free market. And I'm like, well, it's up to us for us to rebrand capitalism. So in business, you have all these statements. You have financial statements. You have this statement, profit and loss statement. You got all mission statement. You got all these statements. I don't know that you can have a business anymore without a community impact statement. It needs to be well thought out. It needs to be publicized. It needs to be in and on your balance sheet so that you know that as you're acquiring resources and as you're growing as a business, what else are you doing, not just in your spare time, but that's pre-planned for so you can tackle one of a plethora of issues or problems that are going on in your city. So I advise every young entrepreneur to get a community impact statement and put that right next to your mission statement.
Well, Jesus Gray, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you so much.
It's a changing of the guard at local nonprofit Yoga for Change. Founder Catherine Thomas is stepping down next month. New executive director Michelle LeClaire is taking over the organization. Yoga for Change offers healing programming to veterans, young people, those who are incarcerated, and people with mental health conditions. And they operate across North and South Florida, Tampa Bay, Central Florida. They've really expanded over the years. From here in Jacksonville. Right now, we're pleased to welcome both Catherine Thomas and Michelle LeClaire to the show. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good to have you both. Catherine, let's begin with you. You founded Yoga for Change and really made a splash with it. So tell us about this changing of the guard and what you'll be up to once you leave.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for having Yoga for Change on First Coast Connect. I'm really excited. I never really envisioned the organization growing this quickly with this much support. And although I believe I was put on this earth to start Yoga for Change, I know that right now the organization needs somebody like Michelle who has that fire in the belly, excitement about expanding nationwide and globally. And so we're at a great point. We have a really strong foundation. We survived COVID-19 with, you know, crawling through the muck of it, if you will, just like the last guest had. I'm really excited to see where the organization will go and expand to. So we're it's been a great learning for me since founding the organization and having to learn every day on how to make everything work. But with Michelle's expertise and leadership, the organization is going to thrive as it goes forward.
Yoga for Change, as you said, started in Jacksonville. It's now statewide and looking beyond Florida. Catherine won the Florida Blue Sapphire Awards last year. There have been a lot of awards given to this organization. So, Michelle, as you take over, you'll be running the organization from Key West, but looking to run these in-person and virtual yoga programs across the state and beyond?
Yes, that's right. My hope and dreams and really plans is to take Yoga for Change global. And so we're with Catherine's advice of where we've been and the history, and you know, I'm looking now to the future to see where we can expand to and how we can get to that global, you know, plan.
Let's talk about how this model works. Catherine, you created this, and the idea is yoga as medicine for hurting groups of people. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this and how this program works.
Well, I was my first career was being a naval helicopter pilot, and I was injured while on deployment and told I'd never fly again. And so my physical therapist recommended that I start to practice yoga to help with my physical, you know, pain, but also it started to help with my mental, emotional pain that I was having because I dreamt always of flying helicopters for the Navy. So the practice itself, I went into it for a physical healing, and I didn't realize the mental, emotional benefits. And fast forward a couple years, because of the Chartrand Family Fund and because of a lot of donors and supporters from this community and a fantastic board, we were able to prove that yoga helps mental and emotional trauma both on a quantitative and a qualitative level. So with that research and that foundation, we were able to actually tell our donors and the different facilities that we partner with what the program was doing for that individual. And that led to the Florida Blue Foundation seeing the impact, you know, really just seeing the stats and the data and seeing the science and believing the science that we were able to prove. And that allowed us to spread across the state. And what's different about Yoga for Change in comparison just to a normal yoga studio, you know, which is still very, very beneficial, is we've been collecting data pre and post class. And taking that data and uplifting the whole yoga sector has been our goal. And I believe with Michelle's leadership, we can increase partnerships, we can expand in a really strategic and sustainable way to allow both more individuals who are suffering because of, you know, just the effects of COVID, if you will, the stress and anxieties of maybe not knowing what their future holds, but also really helping other facilities help their employees with, you know, burnout and compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma as well, to really, again, scale across the nation in a sustainable and really hopeful and powerful way.
So, Michelle, that's a big portfolio for you to take over, taking Yoga for Change across the country. How is that going to work? Tell us what you're thinking.
Yeah, it's a lofty goal for sure, but I think it's definitely doable. I mean, currently we have a really unique partnership with the specialty court system in Duval County, where individuals that may be sentenced to probation could choose to do Yoga for Change for 6 weeks instead of probation and other things like that. So we can actually service all four of our special populations through the specialty court system. And so I believe that that's a really untapped market that we could use to expand across the entire country.
And because of the pandemic, it's been a mixed blessing in the sense that virtual programming can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
We've all figured that out. And how much demand is there for you to do this virtually? What are you seeing?
I believe that there is the in-person connection. I think the social connection is an added benefit for our classes. But because we are able to meet our students where they are, no matter where they are. I believe that expansion has shown that everybody has the ability to, you know, stop, take a breath, and then think before they act. And that's been really beneficial to, you know, people tuning into our virtual classes, but also just going to our YouTube station and having access to the multiple different, you know, times, you know, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes here, taking that time for yourself allows you to show up and connect to your loved ones, your employees, your clients in a whole new way.
So, Michelle, you are now the face of Yoga for Change. Catherine Thomas, what are your future plans? What's next for you?
Well, I'm going to take a break. I started this organization in 2014, and I never really thought it would get this big. And so I'm going to take a year of just not saying yes to anything and just sort of settling back into who Catherine Thomas is without the Yoga for Change. And my family and I are actually moving to Oregon. And so that'll be a nice time just to focus on reestablishing ourselves out in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, best of luck and congrats on the huge impact you've made. Catherine Thomas stepping down at Yoga for Change, Michelle LeClaire taking over. This organization did start small in Jacksonville and has grown by leaps and bounds. You can check it out at y4c.org, the letter Y, the number 4, the letter C.org, Yoga for Change, which has just won raves from so many groups and so many organizations, helping veterans, the incarcerated, people with mental health issues through a purpose-driven yoga curriculum. Ladies, congrats, and I look forward to more success in the future. Thank you both, Catherine Thomas and Michelle LeClaire, for joining us, and best of luck on the new chapter.
Thank you so much.
Again, that website, y4c.org. Well, in a moment, a big deadline is coming up this week. And parents, listen up. It's your last chance to lock in tuition costs for your child under Florida Prepaid. We will touch base with the Florida Prepaid College Board in just a few minutes, tell you everything you need to know about open enrollment because it is ending this Friday. College costs are out of control, as we all know. This is one way to get a handle on it. So keep listening if you have a high school senior in your household or even if you have a newborn baby. We'll be right back.
The Florida land boom of the 1920s and the subsequent bust was experienced differently by African Americans. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with historian Julian Chambliss. We'll discuss Florida food history and the S.H. Johnson X-ray Clinic in Miami. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Volunteers in the Saguaro National Park are on a mission to save the most iconic cactus in the Southwest, where invasive buffel grass is turning the Sonoran Desert into a tinderbox.
Many of the young saguaros die in a fire, so If we let buffel grass just fill this in, we're going to lose saguaros.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, investigative reporter Michael Moss. His bestseller, Salt, Sugar, Fat, explored food companies' aggressive marketing of highly processed, unhealthy foods. His new book examines the addictive properties of processed foods and the food giants' efforts to keep us eating them. It's called Hooked. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Riding high on the success of WandaVision, Marvel continues its TV takeover with Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It's one of 12 new superhero shows coming to Disney Plus, courtesy of Marvel. But as the streaming landscape goes super, the prestigious of Hollywood's prestige award shows keeps it formal. We'll have the Oscar winners and losers on the hit list next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Florida prepaid plan is urging families across the state emerging from the challenges of this pandemic to plan ahead with optimism for their children's post-secondary education. Now, prepaid plan open enrollment ends this Friday. It's your last chance to lock in current prices for future tuition costs. I got more information from Shannon Colavecchio. She is the spokesperson for the Florida Prepaid College Board.
Hi, Shannon. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, an important deadline is coming up for Florida prepaid. Parents need to prick up their ears. Let's talk about the opportunity to get into this open enrollment so that they can start saving for their kids' college education. Tell us what's in store over the next week and what they need to do.
Yes, so we have the final 8 days of open enrollment. This is the window every year, February 1 through April 30th, when families can lock in our current plan pricing, and that guarantees that their future college or university tuition costs are covered based on the plan that they choose.
Okay, what has this been like through the pandemic? Any special challenges or information families should know about?
Well, you know, I think the first initial thought would be that plan sales would slow down, but we actually, even last year when we had open enrollment during the pandemic and continuing through this year, our plan sales are still strong. And I think part of that is because our plans are guaranteed by the state of Florida. You don't have to worry about the ups and downs of the stock market. It is something that is certain, right, that families can save for amid a time of great uncertainty. And I think for a family that maybe feels like there isn't much that they can count on nowadays, mm-hmm. you know, it is something that a parent can do and feel good that they're doing that for their child. And more importantly, you know, they can choose the plan that they're saving for, so they can do it in a way that fits their budget.
Right. I mean, the plans are as low as $40, $50 a month, and then they go up from there. But essentially, what this mm-hmm. does is you lock in your child's tuition costs years in advance. Can you explain how it works?
That's right. So we essentially, we have actuaries that do estimating of, you know, what do we think tuition will be like in, say, 18 years? And that is based on a few factors. One is, what is current tuition? Where do we see the tuition trends going? And then a little bit of an investment yield, right? Because we do that for you and we manage it for you. And so, for example, the lump sum price for a four-year university plan this year is about $28,000. If you start saving for that this year in monthly payments for a newborn, it's about $181. So when it's time for that child to go to college in 18 years, we're going to cover that tuition no matter how much it's gone up and no matter the fact that we actually estimate the actual cost by then will be over $60,000. So it allows families to start saving today in a way that is, you know, digestible, affordable, very predictable. Like, once you set your monthly payment plan, it will never go up. So it's something that you can truly budget for and guarantee.
Now, I know you get asked this quite a bit. Does Florida prepaid only work at Florida colleges and universities, or can it be exported out of state if your child decides to go somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get this a lot. You're right. It can be exported out of state. It can also be used at a private institution, in state or out. And so what would happen is we would apply the value of your plan. So, for example, whatever we would have sent to University of South Florida or FSU or UF, we would send to the institution your child attends what we would have sent to that university or college based on the plan that they chose. So you can never lose the value that you put in. Now, if you're going out of state, your tuition may be higher because you are an out-of-state resident, but you've never lost the value of what your prepaid plan holds.
Mm-hmm. And if your child is getting scholarships, how does the plan work?
Well, that is good news because typically what happens is, you know, I use Bright Futures as an example a lot. If a child has Bright Futures and they had a prepaid plan, what we see happen typically is that there is money left over either in the Bright Futures portion or the prepaid portion, depending on what the family decides to use first, right, toward the tuition. And so they get a check every semester back for whatever was not used. And so with a prepaid plan, anything that you do not use, you can always get a full refund of that. And so that is what families typically will use for the other costs of college, right? Books, housing, technology, because we know tuition is a cost, but there's also all of the other costs of college that can quickly add up.
Oh, yes. It sure does. Okay. Yeah. So again, the deadline is coming up on Friday, April 30th. So people need to start enrolling their child now. If you've got a newborn, you know, you're listening to this, get on this website. How can people enroll their child in My Florida Prepaid?
Yeah, so it's myfloridaprepaid.com is the website. There's a great feature on there that is a pricing calculator, and it allows you to enter the birth date of your child and see exactly what each of the plans would cost per month based on that age. We encourage families to look at the prices and determine what, not necessarily what you aspire for your child to do, right? Like, that's always great if you can afford it, but also what can you afford? So if you look at the four-year university and you think, we can't afford that right now, but we can afford the two-year college, well, if you save for that, at least you're covering their AA degree, right? And so just, you know, every bit that you save is a portion that they're not having to borrow or get a student loan for. And the process only takes about 15 minutes online, so it's very quick.
MyFloridaPrepaid.com. Open enrollment ends Friday, April 30th. Shannon Colavecchio is the Florida Prepaid College Board spokesperson. Thanks so much, Shannon.
Thank you very much.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers today and people who tweeted and emailed, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We appreciate all of your feedback. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast will be up later today on all platforms. You can also listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Going to be a beautiful week. Not too hot just yet. Get out and enjoy it. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.